This podcast is sponsored by El Spelio, makers of some of the finest caving lights on the planet. If you are looking to upgrade your game and invest in a serious light that can take a beating and will be the subject of light envy, and we've all had that, then visit elspelio.com. I've got a link in the description of this podcast, elspelio.com, and you'll save $20 if you enter the promo code podcast with the purchase of any light or any regularly priced order over $300. And by the way, if you want to try it before you buy it, and I'm talking about their top-of-the-line light, the Lunatic, send me an email. I'm in the NSS directory. I got a couple parties interested right now, and I'm trying to decide who's going to get it. Lane Roberts of Texas was the last person to borrow my El Spelio Lunatic, and it's not like I'm using it. I got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old at home. I'm not going caving that often. And besides, I've got another El Spelio on my helmet, so I'm good. You want my Lunatic to use for a few months? Take it. As long as you're going to take it to some cool places, put it through its paces, and send me some pictures. That's all I really need. Here's the email address, alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. And again, if you want to own your own Lunatic or any of the other great products that they sell at elspelio.com, use the promo code PODCAST. This is the Caving Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a monthly podcast, comes out on the first of every month. Interviews with cavers about caving. And if this is your first time, this is a great one to start with because Riley is an incredible caver. I was just kind of in awe at not only her experience, you know, and what she's done, but also her ability to communicate it. Yeah, every once in a while, I'll do one of these interviews, and in the middle of it, I'll know, oh my gosh, I'm going to be spending forever editing this thing. Because I always edit to try to make everybody sound like they've been in a million interviews before, and they've like got media experience. I don't think Riley does, but it sure as hell sounds like she does. I'm really, really impressed by her, and I really appreciate her giving me the time. We'll get to her in a little bit, but back to caving. Yeah, if this is your first time and you're interested in caving, my suggestion to you would be to find your local grotto. They usually have plenty of people who are willing to take beginners because caving is like a lot of things. It can be really dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Quite the opposite if you do, but the only way to know what you're doing is to do it with people who do and ask questions and learn a few things along the way. A few trips like that, and maybe you'll lead your own trips. But until then, do it the right way, and they'll be able to tell you what the right way is and who to go with. And again, you can find your local grotto through the NSS website. I've got a link in the description of this podcast that'll take you to a list of grottos throughout the country. And chances are there's one close by to you. And you know what's great? I mean, there's very little that's great about the pandemic, but one thing is that a lot of grottos are doing meetings virtually, or at least if they're still meeting in person, there's a virtual element. So if you're not comfortable going out yet, or if maybe you live far away from where they meet, you can still, quote unquote, go to the meeting. I got toddlers that go to bed at 7:30 at night. I can't go to my meetings anymore. And I got a meeting this Wednesday. I'll be on the Zoom call. And I'm so thankful for that because my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, they're my buds and I love them and I want to see them. But family to me is more important. However, any way I can, I'm going to try to connect with those guys. So it's good that I can kind of still go to those meetings. All right. One thing I've been thinking about doing with the podcast, and let me know if you're interested in this. I've been thinking about putting out bonus episodes. Because sometimes I'll meet and I'll talk to cavers and they'll just start going off on their favorite cave. And one thing I'm thinking about doing is just doing like shorter interviews with anybody, really. I mean, it can even be with people that I've had on before. And if we could just spend, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes nerding out about your favorite cave, I think that'd be kind of cool, right? I could turn that into a little bonus episode to get you through. Maybe I'll put those out once a month in addition to this. I don't know. Look, I'm just spitballing. It's just an idea that I've had. If you're interested, I would love to have you do that. You can reach out to me via email, alpineproductions@gmail.com. I'm also on social media, Matt Pelser Radio, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. By the way, thanks to all the new Instagram followers following my call out last month. I really appreciate that. And if you're a caver, I'll follow you back. I've been really digging all the new stories. And thanks for posting your caving life on Instagram. I appreciate it. I've been caving vicariously with a bunch of new Instagram friends. But yeah, I mean, like if you want to just go off for 15, 20 minutes about your favorite cave, let me know. And we'll set up a Zoom call or something. And maybe I'll start putting out more than one episode a month. alpineproductions@gmail.com or direct message on socials, Matt Pelser Radio, all one word. There is one little technical thing that I want to address before you listen to this. I talked last month about my obsession with microphones, and I did this interview with Riley with another one of my silly vintage microphones, and something messed up with it. Like, it's not that bad, but you'll know it when you hear it. I don't know if it's the microphone or if it's the compressor or any of the other pieces of gear that I'm going through here, but it got a little scratchy at a few points, and I'm using the same microphone right now. It's gold, which looks really cool, and I know nobody cares about that but me. But anyway, the audio kind of screwed up a little bit, and it got a little scratchy at a few points. Forgive that. My apologies. It's not about me anyway. It's about Riley. Oh, my gosh. How incredible is Riley Blackwell? She worked at the NSS for a little while. She's currently going to the University of Akron. She's working in Dr. Hazel Barton's lab. We talked about the 2021 expedition to Cheve, which she was a very, very involved participant in. We talked about hard caving in Maryland. We talked about her getting her start in Virginia. Riley was truly an inspiring caver to talk to, and I hope you enjoy this. This is my conversation with Riley Blackwell. So you got hooked up with Bill Stone, and you've done some Cheve stuff. What is it like being on that crew? I mean, like, from an outsider's perspective, it just seems like there are expectations, and you got to be fit. You got to know what you're doing. You got to have all the etiquette down and things like that. From somebody who's been there, what's it like, would you say?
So I went there. I went to Mexico for the first time in 2019. So I started caving at the end of 2016 in Virginia.
That was when you started
the CPI Cave Club. Yeah, 2016. So like I count my caving anniversary as being October 15th, 2016.
Wow.
So I was quite new, I think, by anybody's standards, the first time I went to Mexico. And I had very few expectations that first time I went. I would say with Cheve, a lot of the people who go are many of the best cavers I've ever met, like the strongest, the most experienced. The general level of expertise there is very, very high. There's a strong international contingent, so we have a lot of Mexican participants, many of whom are incredible cavers. I think it's really great that the expedition has so many Mexican participants as well. That's notable. And then we have a lot of Polish cavers, who the Poles are very good vertical cavers. Generally, some of them are experienced cave divers as well. And then we have a number of Canadians, and then a smattering of people from other places. So there's definitely, I feel like, a selection of, you know, people from kind of all over the world, and especially all over North America, who have really put in a lot of time. I definitely didn't consider myself to be part of that group of people, especially when I first went in 2019, but there's a range. I mean, there's a lot of people there who have done a couple smaller expeditions, and Cheve is kind of their first major one. And Cheve, as far as I know, there aren't any other cave expeditions like it in terms of the scale and the number of participants that I'm familiar with anyway, not that I'm really an expert. So I think for a lot of us, even for people who've been caving for decades, coming to Cheve is also their first time doing something where there's, you know, 45 or 40 other people on site. So for me, I especially that first time around, I was pretty much just amazed to be able to see the cave and to be able to hang out with those people. That first year there's two main entrances of Cheve that we use. The main classic massive Cheve entrance that Carol Vesely talked about on your podcast.
The big old sinkhole, and, yeah.
Yeah. And then also another one called Peña Negra, or its first name was CL6. And so when I was first there, I went into CL6 for about 5 days and did some survey. And that was like very similar to a lot of other caving that I had done, except a lot of the passage was bigger. And then also in 2019, I went down to a camp called Camp Butters, and I ended up staying there for 2 weeks, 13 days, and digging a lot. So just kind of working on a dig there.
Did you get through?
We did not.
Oh, isn't that just the way it goes?
It sure was the way it went. And that expedition ended up finding some really cool things, but that was towards the end when I left. So that was kind of crazy. Like, that trip with the long camp and lots of digging, on that trip I went through the salmon ladders, which is the really wet kind of exciting part of the cave. And I got really excited about both Cheve the cave itself and the community there, the people that I had met, and especially the people that I had been digging with. It was a very special bonding experience. So I was really excited to come back in 2021 when they did the really long trip. So I was there for 100 days in 2021.
Daggone. Wow. 100 days last year.
Yeah, they called it the 100-day push.
So I guess we found some stuff then. Probably not much we could talk about, but...
So I actually emailed Bill, and he said I can talk about it, no problem.
Oh, wow. Oh, great.
Yeah, so there is going to be a documentary, and the documentary is an episode of National Geographic Explorer, but basically that restriction for us surrounding the documentary, as Bill put it, means we're not allowed to, like, go on primetime and give an exclusive interview, which I don't think anybody has been trying to interview us for primetime.
Yeah, so that's not this either. So that's awesome. Okay. Oh, that's terrific. Man, well, I mean, 13 days. Okay, let's go back to the Butters thing, Camp Butters. Were you there? I mean, you camped there for 13 days, but was it a two-week dig?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And it actually was. Previously, some of the Polish cavers and my friend Corey Hackley had dug a lot in that same area, and Adam Bird as well. A bunch of people were involved with that. They broke into one big chamber, kind of a really big kind of classic Cheve breakdown chamber with a lot of rock stoping in on both sides. And so they broke through the one side of this big chamber, and then we had a dig at the other side trying to continue this big borehole called the Cais de Popolo. And that effort in the dig is one piece of what they've been trying to do at Cheve, which is basically bypass the sumps. So I don't know if you know very much about the history of Cheve exploration, and I don't really, not having been there, but
I mean, I read the one really dramatic book. I haven't read Bill's book yet, Bill and Barbara's book yet, but yeah, no, not a ton that I know right now.
Yeah. So the gist of it is in 2017, there was a big push to dive the sumps. So they established Camp 4 in Cheve, kind of near what was at the time the bottom. It passed the sumps. And so that took a monumental quantity of effort, mostly just like tons of people carrying dive tanks. And then you needed these really skilled cave divers who could do the entire cave and also do these demanding dives at the bottom. So it's been in everybody's interest the entire time to find a dry way down, basically, to not have to stay with the water. And in Cheve, there's a lot of development of these large upper-level fossil trunks that are dry and abandoned. And a lot of those are present in the Peña Negra area in CL6. So this dig was an effort to make one of those go in a way that would bypass the sumps. And that's what the 2021 expedition finally ended up doing through a completely different route. Butters has been abandoned. Thank goodness.
Well, I mean, it didn't seem like there was much there for you to begin with. Okay, so you did find a way around.
Yeah. So, and I surely someone is going to correct you about some of these timelines because I wasn't there for them. But basically, my understanding is just past Camp 3, there's an area called the BQ survey. And at the end of 2017, there were some people, including Corey Hackley, who were interested in poking around in that area. And there's like a lot of breakdown. It's really complicated, very hard to find the way through. This is at Camp 3, so it's just around 1,000 meters. And then Camp 4 is about 500 meters below that, around 1,500 total. So 2017, Corey and some other people were poking around in this area called the Mad Hatter, which is in the BQ survey, which is just like a breakdown maze, basically. And then in 2018, there were a number of people who were working on that as well. In 2019, after the Butters dig was abandoned, after I left Cheve to go to Wattla, the Poles and some other people, a big contingent of Polish cavers and a couple Slovenians, broke through the Mad Hatter and all the way through this long section of breakdown after that called the Mad Cow Slaughterhouse. And when they broke through the Mad Cow Slaughterhouse, they broke into a big borehole, an awesome borehole called the Purgatory Borehole.
Wow.
So that was all at the end of 2019. A lot of us didn't know exactly what the character of that lead was like, but I think it had been pretty well distributed that there was going to be something exciting happening. So 2021 was entirely focused on establishing a camp in the Purgatory Borehole, supporting that camp, and doing exploration from there. And as a team, we ended up establishing Camp 5, which is in the Purgatory Borehole, in February, and then Camp 5.5 in March, and Camp 6, and then 7 in April. So we went a long way. And it's quite challenging to work back there because of the aforementioned Mad Hatter and the Mad Cow Slaughterhouse, because those are breakdown zones. So at Cheve, you don't have to take off your pack all the way from the entrance to Camp 3, basically.
Wow.
You know, okay. You might tether it, but like you're walking pretty much. You're walking or you're on rope or you're swimming the entire time. So it's a pretty different character than a lot of us in the East Coast or the Eastern Seaboard are used to.
Yeah.
But when you get to the Mad Hatter and the Mad Cow Slaughterhouse, suddenly like your giant pack that you took to Camp 3 won't even fit. And so you end up carrying like two small packs. You're using your upper body a lot. You're pushing things in front of you. And for taller people and for people without a lot of experience, like in crappy breakdown caves, that section of the cave is very challenging for everyone, really. And just very challenging to move a huge volume of stuff through. So supporting successive camps past the Mad Cow Slaughterhouse was what seems to me kind of the central challenge of facilitating exploration this year.
And so was that then your job to, I mean, I'm picturing what's needed here. Like you're talking about people coming in, like you said, you can pretty much be upright with a decent sized pack until you get to the breakdown, the Mad Hatter breakdown. And then what? Are you Sherping things through that to get to the camps?
Yeah.
So is that what you were doing?
We all were. I mean, basically any of us who were doing exploration past Camp 3 were involved in a lot of hauling.
Yeah.
And they called it, the leadership called it an inverted pyramid. So the idea is basically that you need this great amount of people and supplies to go to Camp 2, and then a slightly smaller amount of people and supplies to go to Camp 3, and a slightly smaller amount to go to Camp 5. But each one of those populations of people at the camp has to also be fed, right? So there's a huge amount that has to come in up to Camp 3, and then we'll just get as much through the cows to Camps 5 and 6 as we could. I did end up doing a fair bit of hauling in the cows, in large part just because I really wanted to be involved with the exploration that was happening down deep there. And the first month of the expedition, I was in the process of healing a torn rotator cuff and rehabbing it, which was hard in that kind of terrain. So yeah. I didn't spend quite as much time in that environment as some other people did. But any of us who were full-time, we spent a lot of time in the cows. Yeah, for sure.
I'm very curious about the kind of the pecking order for a huge expedition like this. And I'm sure it's different for everyone. But where this one's concerned, I mean, you being a new but extremely experienced and capable and effective caver, where were you and where were some of the people above you? Is there an above and a below? I mean, obviously you got to do some exploration, so you got to do something. How did it get ordered around, I guess?
So I actually got to do a lot of exploration, and I feel very fortunate about that. You know, I think no one wants there to be a pecking order, right?
Right, like, yeah.
It is a collective effort, and there's a community there with the Cheve people and the U.S. Deep Caving team. Obviously, Bill is in charge. It's his deal. He's put just so many thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of work, both underground and above ground in terms of organization, into that expedition over decades into that cave. And then there are other members of the leadership team. That's Sean Lewis and Bev Shade. And both of those people also spent a huge amount of time doing like organizational things beforehand. Then we have some other people who have been long-term expedition participants who have been really successful, like navigating the breakdown and working on finding more passage, pushing hard stuff in Cheve before, who kind of ended up as sort of team leaders. But it's not quite that strict like that. I would say there were definitely some times, especially at the beginning of the expedition, where I was kind of stuck higher up in the cave than I would have liked to be. Uh-huh. And I do think there is a piece of perception, especially if you're young and female, that, you know, people are going to, if you're going 1,000 meters deep in a hard cave, you know, you're going to take the people that you think are really going to be able to support you. And I don't blame anybody for that. That's totally understandable. It's serious business, you know. I think there is a time of kind of proving, especially if you're younger or newer, where you have to put in some evidence that you can keep up and that you can contribute, both in terms of carrying things and navigating the cave, and also in terms of actually surveying and exploring. Very luckily for me, I and Sean Lewis found an area close to Camp 1 that we actually ended up mapping about 2 kilometers in.
Wow.
So while the expedition was getting going and everybody was kind of busy hauling and taking things down, we hauled a lot in the beginning as well, but we kind of got to take these rest trips, or we called them like a vacation trip, to Camp 1 to survey there. And our initial intent there under Camp 1 was to try to find a dry way above the salmon ladders, which is that section I mentioned before that's really wet and challenging. Mm. So we had, you know, a good reason to be there. But I found Sean had identified a lead in that area, and I squeezed through something really, really small. And it actually went really well. We mapped a lot of passage there. So that was helpful for me to have a place to put my energy until I was able to get down deeper in the cave. And I also think maybe that helped give some evidence that, like, I was able to sketch and that I could fit through small spaces and break down and things like that would make you useful on the frontier.
Wow. But I mean, man, it just illustrates the vastness of that system. The fact that, and I don't know how the camps are arranged, but I would imagine that it's traditional. Camp 1 was the first established camp in this particular area. And to know that there are a few kilometers of Virgin Cave there that you found, I mean, that's just pretty cool. Obviously, it was a small way to, a little keyhole to get in, it seems like. Okay, so if you're on a Cheve expedition in the first place, it doesn't matter how high or low on the rung. And it doesn't seem like there really is one. It seems like it's a pretty democratic arrangement, or at least an equitable arrangement of people. Since you're all there, you're all capable, you all get to go do something cool. But in order to get to that point, you have to have done a lot prior to that. And you having started just 5 years ago, can we go back to the beginning? You said West Virginia?
Yeah, so I'm from Virginia. I grew up in Southwest Virginia, really close to some of the caves there, actually.
Beautiful,
in Giles,
yeah.
County. But I did a lot of my kind of earlier project caving in West Virginia, and still am excited about project caving in West Virginia. So I guess we'll go backwards from Cheve. I got invited to Cheve initially in 2019 by talking to Bev Shade in particular, who ran an expedition to Main Drain in Utah. Mm. And that was in the summer of 2018. So I was a participant there, which meant that I just carried basically dive tanks down to the sump in Main Drain and climbed back out, and then went in and did it again 2 days later, which was awesome. That was an incredible trip. Main Drain is one of the coolest caves I've ever been in. And I got invited on that trip because I was already out west, because I was going to Silvertip with Jason Bolensky. That was also in the summer of 2018. And I got invited to Silvertip because I cold emailed Jason Bolensky and said that I wanted to go.
Okay.
And I had never met him before, and I had never been west of the Mississippi at all. I had never been in an alpine cave or on anything anyone would consider an expedition. And at the time that I went, at the time I signed up to go on the trip, I had never met anyone who was going to be on the trip at all. So that was like, I don't know. I had heard about Silvertip. An important thing there, I think, is there's a lot of, I think the term expedition caver is kind of silly, but there's a lot of project cavers and people who have done international project caving in Blacksburg. So when I started in 2016, like the first cave club meeting I ever went to Mike and Andrea Futrell were giving a presentation on their expedition to Myanmar. So that was kind of immediately, I was like, okay, this is a sport that can do a lot of different things, right? You can do a lot of different things with this. This isn't just crawling in the mud. You know, people are doing this for science and for exploration in all kinds of places. So I did a bunch of project caving kind of around Virginia. And then I moved to TAG to work for the NSS. I learned to aid climb there and was involved with a couple of projects that I had more of a leadership role in, was doing more of the sketching, and then just emailed Jason and got some recommendations from some Virginia cavers that knew me well, and went out west, and everything sort of started to develop from that. I think going to Main Drain was helpful because Main Drain's really vertical, and Cheves obviously quite vertical. So having done a cave that was rigged with rebelays and had significant depth to it, and shown that I could like carry heavy things and not mess myself up in that environment, was helpful. But you know, they're always going to bring people on the trip that feel like can contribute, but also feel like they can get along with. I think it's much more important to be able to get along with people in that kind of setting where you're there for 3 months than it is to be able to carry a lot of heavy things or move fast.
Indeed. Well, okay. So it seems like since the beginning, it's been a very serious thing for you. Whereas, you know, some people kind of dabble in the recreational and they'll get serious every once in a while. But it seems like you've had the target in your sights the whole time. When did you know that this was a thing that you were into? Like, how did that come about?
Well, I've said this to a couple of people, which is that in the past 5 years, I haven't really had anything else to worry about. So a lot of people are in school and college during the time that they start caving. And so they have to kind of split their focus between classes. And then a lot of people get important jobs that are time consuming right after college. When I started caving, I was working basically a dead end food service job in Blacksburg. And like I said, Blacksburg is the home of a lot of people with a lot of caving experience. I think in 2017, I started at the end of 2016. In 2017, one of the Blacksburg cavers went to Cheve that spring. And he came back. So I'd been caving for like 4 or 5 months at that point. He came back and I heard about the trip and I was like, oh, I want to go there. So Cheve actually, I think, was instrumental in that for me. It was a very specific goal of like, it sounded like a cave that I would just fall in love with. And the idea of going to Mexico was really exciting. So probably around that time, I think I started to open myself up to the possibility of going other places. But I think it's important for me to have a relationship to caving that's not focused around just like whatever the next shiniest trip is, or, you know, the most exciting place to go. The reason that I've been so committed to caving and put so much time into it is because it's given me all the things that I have in my life. You know, all my close friends are cavers. All my partners have been cavers. Much of my employment and now my education is related to caving, or people that I've met through caving. And there's an opportunity to connect with people and teach new people and contribute to conservation and science. And those things are extremely rewarding in and of themselves. And I think for me, leaning into that aspect of my life has been really productive, and has also, as sort of a byproduct, enabled me to go to some of these interesting places. But I'm not, you know, I'm certainly not the strongest or the fastest of the people who are on these expeditions. And I think it's important not to be on these expeditions to like check off some kind of box of somewhere you want to visit. Because if that's your reason for being there, you know, when you've been in the cave for 17 days, you're not going to be psyched about being in the cave anymore because you've already seen it and you want to get out, right? And you're stinky and like your body hurts and you're injured and your feet are rotting. And I think being invested in it for exploration and being invested in the community that you're there with is just more natural. And for me, it has taken me a lot farther kind of having that viewpoint of it.
Well, and it seems like it really, I mean, obviously guided you to the University of Akron and working with Hazel Barton there. I mean, I've wanted to ask her this, but I'll ask you too, because you're there. not a lot of caves around there. I mean, you know, I mean, she goes to South Dakota. She goes all over. But I mean, and then you've got your thing. Do you do any of the stuff? I mean, I know Cuyahoga Valley National Park is there. It's a bunch. There's some shelter caves and stuff there. Do you even count that? Are you doing anything in there?
No. I mean, so I'm in a geology 101 class right now.
Yeah.
And somebody else in the class asked my professor about caves. And he was like, yeah, there's a lot of caves in Southern Ohio. And I was like, oh, God, no. Don't lie to me like this.
Yeah.
I don't think
they wouldn't even call those caves in some states.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's good for me to be in a place that doesn't have caves nearby.
All right. I get that.
Yeah. I almost went to West Virginia University in Morgantown. I was accepted there and they have an amazing cave club. Their student grotto is doing really awesome stuff right now.
I went caving with some of them, I think.
Good energy. Yeah. Those kids are really great. And that's, you know, right next to my favorite caves probably in the country, which are in Germany Valley, West Virginia. But I'm pretty sure based on my experience living in Blacksburg that if I was there right next to caves, there is a strong chance I wouldn't really be getting any schoolwork done. So being about 5 or 6 hours from caves is a good medium for me right now. Actually, some of the cavers I most look up to, Andrea Futrell and also Bill Storage, went to Akron. So Mike and Andrea told me that if I went to Akron, I was going to survive and I just needed to drive down and go project caving. And luckily the other project area that I'm most invested in, which is in Maryland, is only about 4 hours from here. And I'm also very fortunate to have some people up here that I can carpool with who are also serious about caving. So I go between probably 1 to 3 weekends a month. I'm able to do a number of camp trips, and that's been enough for now.
When you brought up Germany Valley in West Virginia, I'm not terribly familiar with that area, but I've heard of it. What's there? You said favorite caves are there. What do you like?
Yeah. So the main ones that people have heard of in Germany Valley are Shovel Eater and Memorial Day, Shovel Eater Hellhole, which is a system with two entrances.
I've heard of that one actually. Yeah.
Yeah. That one's pretty famous. The Hellhole entrance is closed because it's an important bat hibernaculum. Schoolhouse also is in that area. That's a really famous cave because a lot of American vertical technique was developed there. That's also closed because it's an important bat hibernaculum. And the Germany Valley caves have some of their really big aid climbs that have been done in the past 5 or 10 years. So like Philosopher's Dome, Perseverance Dome, Flying Dutchman. There's a couple others. Derek Bristol and Pete Johnson and Gilly Elor and a number of other people have been putting up really tall, up to 500 plus feet aid climbs in there. So I think that's kind of why it's made the caving news a little bit, but they're just really interesting caves. There's a lot of passage density. They have a character that kind of varies between muddy stuff, which I like, and then like really dry gypsum-y stuff with nice formations, which I also like. There's a lot of large passages. There's like hard breakdown stuff, and they do a lot of cave camping, and I really like cave camping. So that's been an area that I've been really excited to participate in. I'm not in charge of any projects up there. I just work on other people's stuff, but I really like just kind of that environment, both in terms of the caves and the people.
So a variety, like a true variety where it's like, you know, in Indiana, you can have variety and there's no vertical element, but it seems like there's variety plus vertical element there. And that is part of the appeal.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of vertical and the rigging is decent. Like, you know, they use rebelays over there, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can do kind of a little bit of everything in those caves.
So let's go back to Maryland. What is it, Tanglefoot?
Yeah. So I think Tanglefoot is the one that would be good to talk about since Tanglefoot's already gotten quite a bit of publicity. It was on like an Outdoor Maryland segment a couple of years ago. And
always interesting when that happens because, you know, we have a complicated relationship with that kind of publicity.
Right, for sure. I think publicity with Tanglefoot is maybe less of a concern than it might be for some other places because Tanglefoot is pretty terrible.
Oh, so not a lot of spelunkers are going to go. Okay.
Yeah, like the segment that aired on Outdoor Maryland, like I saw comments on it on YouTube and stuff, and every single one of the comments is like, "Oh my God, why would you do that? Like that looks horrible." So I'm not like super worried about people trying to go to Tanglefoot. so yeah, that one is, it's a scarp slope cave and it's just super muddy. It has a kind of classic for Tanglefoot characteristic called a pancake crawl, which is the passage is often like 15 feet wide, but you know, between 1 and 2 feet tall and sometimes 8 inches tall.
Whoa.
And it's slightly tilted. So you spend a lot of time like crawling flat in the mud a little bit sideways, which is not, it's a very, very, my friend Corey calls it a very physical type of caving.
Sounds like an understatement. If it's so significant that there was a piece in the media about it, but what is it about that that has gotten it so much attention? Is there something once you get past the hard stuff that's really cool? Like what is it?
Well, there are actually some beautiful walking canyons in Tanglefoot that are formed in the Loyalhanna limestone. The Loyalhanna is a favorite of a lot of local cavers, but I don't think there's anything in Tanglefoot that would normally make it super significant. The interesting thing about Tanglefoot and some of the other things in that area is that they're in Maryland, and there's actually a kind of a, in my opinion, really interesting caving scene in Maryland with a lot of potential. And I think even the media in Maryland knows that it's not that common for people to be caving in significant caves in Maryland. Like that's not something that Maryland's known for. So Tanglefoot was, when Corey and Ryan and a couple of other people started working on it, it was by far the most significant cave in Maryland. It's quite deep. It's over 400 feet deep. And I think for a lot of cavers and even non-cavers, just the fact that that kind of karst existed in Western Maryland was pretty significant.
Is it isolated? I mean, is it, if there aren't that many significant caves in Maryland, and that's kind of the big one that's getting a lot of attention, what is it? Is it, is the karst just in fits and starts and spotty across the landscape in Maryland?
No, there's actually a lot of karst and there are big springs and stuff, but the caves are really hard. So I think you need to be small, like that there are a lot of squeezes in those caves that are in the 8 to 9 inch range. They're very muddy. So you need to, you know, you have to have a cave suit. You need to be very tolerant of the cold or good at dealing with the cold. And then there can be some verticality in that area as well. So it's an interesting thing with how caving communities develop, you know, in Virginia, for example. We have a big pool of people who are psyched on hard caving because there are easy, medium, and hard caves in that area. But I think when most of your caves are hard, it can be a little bit challenging to develop a big pool. It takes a very dedicated individual to develop a karst area like that and kind of help it reach its potential. And again, I'm not in charge of any of that. I'm not in a leadership role, but I've been trying to lead some Tanglefoot trips and participate in some of the other stuff going on. And I'm really excited. That's one of the reasons that it's appealing to me is because it is hard and there's a chance to do a lot of genuine exploration. Stuff hasn't been, you know, super picked over because it is challenging and it isn't everybody that wants to go grovel around in those caves. So I think that's what's exciting about it to me. And I think it's really cool that somebody has developed that karst potential and devoted so much energy to figuring it out in a place where, you know, a lot of times people will be like, Maryland, there's no caves in Maryland. Why are you going to Maryland? But what I'm learning is that where there's limestone, there are caves as long as you're dedicated enough to look for them.
So, okay, say an East Coast caver is hearing this and they're serious about it, fit enough to do it. I don't know. Are you looking for people for this? Every time I ask something like this, you know, they get a little, you know how cavers are. They're like, oh, but this is my project. This is, you know, but it seems like there is a lean but mean group working on this. And could you use help?
So again, I'm not in charge. It's just an area that I'm excited about. So it's not my thing. You know, I definitely wouldn't want to tell anybody a strong yes or a strong no on anything because it's just not really my place to make those kinds of decisions.
Sure.
I have tried to recruit people to come to Tanglefoot with me and nobody really seems to want to go.
Because they know too much?
I'm not really sure. I try to be honest with people about like, here's what the leads look like. Here's what the passage is like. I recommend you have a PVC suit or a Shazam suit. That might be a tricky one for a lot of people, but I mean, sure. Like if people want to come to Tanglefoot with me and get lost in the sauce up there. I would welcome people who are psyched on really terrible caving to get in touch with me, and we'll see what we can do. No guarantees, right? I don't want to overly publicize anything, but
of course
I think it's great to have people who are excited, and if people stay excited after going to the cave, that's even better.
So Kentucky, I mean, you did some Fisher Ridge stuff?
Yeah, I go to Fisher Ridge a fair bit. Again, they cave camp there. I really like to cave camp. They're also doing some aid climbing. There's a lot of leads in Fisher Ridge that are aid climbing heavy. So I've been excited about both climbing in there and like teaching other people to aid climb. I've had some friends come up from Blacksburg and from other places, and we've kind of had some like educational trips where people got to get some practice aid climbing and sketching. I'm really into that. I like helping people advance and build skills. So yeah, I've never been to Mammoth at all. And I guess I might like to go someday. It seems to me that a lot of the caving around there is like pretty similar.
Yeah.
And I really like, I like muddy stuff, and I like vertical, and I like wearing a cave suit. So Kentucky can be a little tricky for me because I'm not very good at functioning unless I have like a really big protective suit layer on. If I have like caving shorts and a t-shirt on, I get really scratched up, and then I get sand in my pants and I get irritated.
I'm the same way. I got a suit a few years back, and I just can't do a trip without it.
Yeah.
I just love it.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's the same for me. But I think it's cool to like the sheer extent of the caves down there, like how far they go and how remote some of the places are in the back of Fisher Ridge. Like there's stuff in there that's 6-7 hours from the entrance. That's cool to me. I've joked with friends before that the style of caving that they do in Fisher Ridge is actually like very alpine, even though the cave isn't alpine at all, because it's extremely fast and light. They have to like go really light and take only the essentials and push really hard to get a long way out there. And I think that's cool to do things in that style. So I've done a couple trips, and I expect I'll continue going there in the future.
I got a few friends that are Fisher Ridge cavers, and it's just, I mean, I've not been myself, but it seems so freaking cool. I mean, it's in the same rock as the cave over the hill, and it just the potential of all of that down there, and also just the human involvement and the specific caver involvement and the politics around it. I mean, it's just, it is really fascinating to me to be in it as sort of a firsthand. You seem really diplomatic when you discuss things. So I feel like you're not going to speak out of turn or say too much, but what's your read on that whole situation?
Well, I might be a little bit biased because I've spent a lot of time hanging out with Indiana cavers. So like, I think, you know, the Detroit Urban Grotto and the Michigan folks, and then that like strong contingent of Indiana people who've done a lot of work in Fisher Ridge. I think those people are awesome. I love their sensibility. You know, a lot of the first like really long kind of death march character trips I heard about were in various sections of Fisher Ridge. And in my experience, the Fisher Ridge project has been very open to people participating and very willing to take new people and teach them stuff. I think any project is kind of limited by its number of trip leaders. So, you know, Fisher Ridge is less institutionalized than the CRF project at Mammoth, which is part of what I like about it. Because in the Virginias, I'm not really used to like a whole CRF or Park Service kind of structure. I can deal with that, but it's not how I prefer to operate ideally. So I like that it's a little bit more like individualized and personal at Fisher Ridge. And I just wish there were more people who could navigate the cave really well. I certainly can't. Like, I could get you to Northtown Camp, but it's really complicated. A lot of the stuff looks the same. So I think if anything is hard about the Fisher Ridge project, it's just having people who can really safely navigate, who also have the endurance for those long trips. But I'm a big fan of the Fisher Ridge project and pretty much everybody I've met who's involved in it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And you're right, there are a lot of Indiana people. Have you done much caving here in Indiana?
I've actually never been caving in Indiana.
Whoa, it's one of the really?
Places that I'd really like to go.
Yeah. Oh, you ought to. I mean, there's definitely some frontier here, and there's a lot going on with the Binkley system. Do you go recreational? I mean, it's all recreational. It's all fun. But are you going to find new cave, right? Most of the time when you're going.
Yeah, I think the last big recreational thing I did was probably in 2018. I led a trip for the VPI Cave Club spring break to down to Tag, which has taken off. Luckily, they've continued doing that trip. And I used to do a fair bit of collaborative photo work with my friend Jacob Lieber, who's a really incredible cave photographer. But when we were doing that, I made him, I had like a one-to-one deal. I told him I would help him on a photo trip, and then he owed me either like carrying my stuff to an aid climb or doing instruments for me on a survey. So we would trade. And as a byproduct of that, I got a lot of really phenomenal pictures of the projects I was working on at the time. And I would still go do photo stuff with him probably just because like we get along so well. I would say that's probably the closest thing I ever do to recreational caving, unless somebody really convinces me to. We have a training program at VPI where people have to do like a test for rigging and other various kinds of tests in caves. So I'll do that sometimes, but I don't really consider that to be recreational because it's really more about like teaching and skill building.
Well, okay. So you spend a good amount of time down in Tag. I mean, you work for the NSS. Among the list of your favorite Tag classics would be what? Like that you visited a lot or that you'll take people if they say, hey, show me around Tag. Where are you going?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, being in Ohio, I don't get the chance to be down there as much as I'd like. But I mean, I loved Ellison's, obviously, when I was there. Before I went to Mexico the first time, I was going to Ellison's a lot to climb out a fantastic pit.
Did you ever do the through trip?
I never did the through trip. Elliot Stahl and Philip Reichwalder and I did an almost through trip where we went down the fantastic side to the bottom of Incredible and back out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Turned Philip's around. Really into like numbers and like kind of ESPN stat kind of thing. So we were trying to do that just like as fast as we could, which was really fun. Actually,
that's
I had
cool.
a phenomenal
yeah.
time on that trip. And I have also done the Incredible side on a photo trip with Jake Lieber and Ryan Maurer. Just once. So I really like Ellison's. I'm a big fan of all the like wet, what the Tag cavers call a wet multi-drop. So like Guy's Cave or Norseman's Wells. As a friend of the Indiana cavers, I call it Norseman's Wells, but no disrespect to anybody who calls it a different name.
I still really got to like get the full story on that. Joe Kinder, if you're listening, he owes me a story about that. Anyway.
Yeah, you'll have to track that down because it's a funny one. But yeah, I pretty much like any of those Alabama trips where you're like really in the water.
Yeah.
And there's like kind of splashy vertical. I did McBride's with Lee White and a couple other VPI people a couple years ago. And that's like one of my favorite trips of all time. That was phenomenal. I'd still really like to do Solution Rift. I would go to Solution Rift on a rec trip someday if I ever had a group that wanted to do it.
Okay, let's go back to Cheve. You camped for 25 days and we got kind of a 1,000-foot view of what went on there. But I don't know if we could get a little closer to it and dig a little deeper. What were some of the highlights of that time?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that because that's some of the coolest caving I think I've ever done. So I don't remember exactly the dates, but Sean Lewis, Derek Bristol, David Stone, Katie Graham, and I, and Adrian Miguel Nieto all ended up in Camp 6 around the same time. And we started that process with surveyed some stuff that had mostly already been explored. There's a funny story where we rigged down into basically like, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this show, a muddy crack would be really the most accurate interpretation of what it was.
Fun.
We rigged down into there and Katie, she's Canadian, super hard caver, used to like really cold, terrible stuff. She set the North American, well, the United States and Canadian non-Mexican depth record a couple of years ago. So Katie like rigs into this hole and the rope's going through like a 9-inch hole and everything's covered in like 3 inches of mud. And she rigs down into there and the entire rest of the group like won't follow her. And David Stone, to his credit, he's a taller guy. He had been like kind of working on his tolerance for tight stuff. And he dove right into that mud hole with Katie. So Katie and David are like slopping around in the mud hole. Everybody else is above, kind of like in this little breakdown area. We're trying to find a way through the breakdown, right, to make the cave go. And so they rig this rope down and like nobody wants to go in it. Like everybody else on the team is like, no, that looks like it sucks. And Katie's getting really cold. Katie and David are both getting really cold because they're waiting down there. They don't have survey stuff. They're just rigging. So they're waiting down there with the survey stuff. And everybody's like, no, we don't want to go in the hole. Derek Bristol's sketching, and he's the cartographer for the cave. So finally, Katie and David squeeze themselves out of this hole, and I'm like, fine, I'll go in the hole. Like, I have a cave suit on. This is what I do, right? It's mud. And I go down there, and Derek, if you know Derek, he's like very dry and sarcastic, obviously. And
yeah.
Derek's sitting up there with a tablet. So I'm like solo surveying, just like absolutely covered in mud, and like it's super tight, and I'm slopping around, and I'm solo surveying and taking shots. And Derek's sitting up there and sketching, and he's saying things like, this is not my skill set. My skill set is borehole. This is Riley's skill set. And like, some people need to know when to cut their losses and things like that. And finally, like, I got to this down climb, and I was like, Derek's 50 feet away. Nobody else is here. It's like a really scary, slippery down climb. So I bailed out of that. And then I almost didn't fit back up through the hole. Like, it was very hard to get out of there, you know, and I've been like strolling through borehole to get to this place for like 5 days. I think I've already been in the cave for like 11 or 12 days at this point. And I was just like, oh my God, like here I am in Mexico, like doing exactly the same, if not worse, things that I'm usually doing in Virginia. So that was like our first day in Camp Six. So, you know, it was hardly like the booty fest everybody seems to think it is all the time.
Yeah.
And we spent the entire next day surveying like side leads and working on penetrating the breakdown. There's a huge breakdown pile, and the Polish team and Corey had done a lot of work in there, but they had some bad air days. So nothing really came up super well. Mm. And at the end of that second day, we popped through into a huge borehole. And we named that one in honor of David, because he had to leave. So we named that one the Oestra Present. And then basically for the next, I don't even know, 6 days, 5 days, we just pretty much surveyed a huge borehole.
Wow.
And that was awesome. Like it was very lucky that I felt very lucky to have arrived at that time. For a minute there, I was a little bit hopeless. Like, what if I come to Camp Six in Cheve and we're just like surveying muddy cracks the whole time? But no, I mean,
somebody's got to do it.
Because we found finally the borehole with this howling air, the characteristic Cheve air. And the end of that process was this massive survey day I did with Sean and Adrian. And Adrian is a Mexican caver, and he's been a participant on like every Cheve and Pesh expedition since they started happening. I think he's really exceptional. And so he was sketching, and I think we set, oh man, I think we did 78 stations, and we were just like cranking them out. Right. And he didn't complain. Like, he never asked us to slow down. He was just like, keep them coming, guys. And he sketched and sketched and sketched. And the final chamber of that line of survey is this room that we called Harmony Hall. And it was, oh gosh, I don't know how tall it is. It's probably like 180 meters tall and 100 meters wide. And it's at the end of this really huge borehole. It's very large. And we called it that because it has like a 10-second echo.
Wow.
So that was really amazing. And again, like for me, that just felt like luck that I had kind of arrived there at the right time. Certainly there was a lot of skill that went into finding that push through the breakdown.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, there are a lot of really skillful people on that trip. And so for me, it just felt really fortunate to be like with the group that was there at that time to do that. And that room actually extended the depth of the cave a little bit. So I think we added like 9 meters or something. I'll have to look at the exact numbers.
Okay. Well, hey, every little bit counts.
But we were, what that meant, we're in a completely different layer of development, right? So what that meant is that we had come all the way up to these fossil passages where Camp 5 is, and then very slowly come down in these boreholes over horizontal distance all the way until we were deeper in space than the previous deep point of the cave, which is the wet area where the sumps are. So that was really exciting. And we had this really cool technology called Cave 3D that allowed us to put the surveys in real time. So we were standing like in Harmony Hall doing the survey, and Adrian put the survey into Cave 3D, and we were actually able to tell that we had made the cave a little bit deeper right there in that moment, which was new for me, like to have that kind of comparison. Usually you wait until the trip's over, and then you go back and put in all the data, and then you have a party about you know, making the cave deeper, but we knew we were there right then, which was amazing.
Yeah. To know that you're in the deep point as it happens. Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. So Harmony Hall then is where that borehole terminates, or that's where you terminated and had to be done.
So the borehole, basically the wall slams down into the floor. It's probably like a big phreatic U-bend that will pop up at some point, but it could be like 100 meters down, and the floor is covered in really small breakdown, covered in a layer of mud. And it actually ends. There's a little tiny sump. There's like a little, you know, Vado stream from the surface that comes in and makes a tiny little pool in the wall of Harmony Hall. It was like a cruel joke, honestly, because, you know, they spent all this time diving the sumps. And then the whole theme of the expedition is like, bypass the sumps, bypass the sumps. And the cave was like, okay, here's, you know, less than 10 meters. And here's another little sump for you to deal with. So then the Canadians, the next day, the Canadians went and like swam around in the sump, and they, you know, they're like digging their toes into the sand. And our friend Colin was like, I've got the deepest foot fungus in Chevet. and they were trying to check out the sump, but nobody ended up diving it. And the rest of the expedition was focused on trying to find ways like up and around that, which is just crazy, you know, to be trucking downhill in a borehole for that long and then have it. The true passage itself doesn't end. Like, I'm sure that borehole continues because of its size, but there's no way we can possibly get to it.
But it is, I mean, I know that you weren't diving, you were trying to do anything but it does kind of seem like that said sump is diveable.
Maybe. And I'm not a cave diver, and I don't want to carry dive tanks to there. So I'm going to let somebody else.
That was going to be my question, is like, what would it take to get the gear there? It seems like it would be a monumental effort.
It would be absolutely insane.
Maybe not even worth it.
I mean, I think for Chevet, anything is worth it that we can do. Again, sure. I don't want to speak for Bill. There's all kinds of things that the USDCT and Bill have done that people have said, you know, that can't possibly be worth it. So I think there's a lot that might be done, but I hope that it's not diving. And I hope that this expedition coming up this year gives us some information that will help us avoid having to go to the point of diving that sump, because the sump isn't formed in the large passage itself, right? The sump is formed in a little intrusion from an infeeder. So it's not impossible that it could pop up into something real, but the sump itself doesn't represent a continuation automatically of that huge borehole. If it does connect with a huge borehole on the other side, I think that would be a feature of luck, basically.
What else on Chevet?
So I'll plug the movie, which will be an hour long. And according to the most recent update, it will come out on Disney Plus and Nat Geo Explorer in the first week of May, along with a story in the main magazine. So if people are interested in that, we had a really interesting time filming with Nat Geo. I did my absolute best not to be in the documentary at all.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you on camera at all?
So I don't know. I mean, I won't know until I see it. I heard that there was a short clip of me featured because of my involvement with the Harmony Hall stuff. But I really tried to avoid the cameras at all. And honestly, I think it was best for everyone that they avoided me because I like swear a lot. And, you know, cavers, we tend to like talk about digestive functions and things that aren't very glamorous. So I had a standing.
Yeah, but they cut all that out.
Yeah, one of the cameramen Chevet was his first cave ever. And he came all the way down to camp.
Holy crap.
To the camp 5.56 area. Several of the Nat Geo people made it all the way down to the bottom of the cave, which I think is really incredible. They're really spectacular athletes. Wow. But I had a standing thing with him where I was like, you know, basically I talk a lot. And if I'm talking, I'm probably going to be either swearing or talking about something gross that you don't want on your audio. So please, like if you're recording, just tell me to shut up or go somewhere else because I don't want to be a part of this and you're not going to be able to use anything that I'm in. So I think I mostly evaded that. But several of my friends I know are in it. I know Bev is in it, who's like one of my heroes. Bill is in it a lot. And they got a lot of really incredible footage. They were flying a drone in Sacnoosthamswell and in the AS borehole. They have really beautiful drone footage of camp. and they got footage of us doing pretty much everything. So I'm really excited to see it. And if people are interested in Cheve, that will definitely be something fun to check out.
Okay. So for Bill to allow that sort of thing, you being as close to the project as you now are, having been involved, what is that, from your perspective, what does that do for the project?
Yeah, what I can say about that is Nat Geo very generously funded the expedition, contributed a very big chunk of funding to specifically that expedition in 2021. So in return, you know, we were all very cooperative with them, but they were quite self-sufficient. They carried a lot of their own stuff, and they certainly made it possible for the USDCT to put on an expedition of that size. So, you know, I thought it was really great that they're still interested in funding that kind of true exploration. We're very grateful for that.
Absolutely. And I mean, to hear that the photographers who made it down for that to be their first cave, were you ever observing this and thinking, oh man, these people don't have it? Because if you're a caver, you cave and you know what it's like, but gosh, if you've never done it before, it doesn't matter how much you've done. There's nothing really that can prepare you for it.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are exceptional athletes. So I should say, one of the main camera people for the Nat Geo documentary is a caver named Kasia Bernaka, who is a cave photographer and a Polish caver. And she has been involved with USDCT Cheve J2 expeditions for a really long time. Mm. She's an extremely experienced caver, both in Poland and Mexico. So she was, of course, like, just happened to also have a camera with her while she was doing everything she normally does.
Yeah.
The other two people, and there was several other Poles with her who were kind of helping her, who were also good camera people. So I shouldn't leave them out. And then the two Nat Geo people that ended up going really deep in the cave, one is a professional rock climber and the other one is a mountain guide, a Denali mountain guide. So they're both like very, very used to not only physically hard stuff, but extreme environments. The one who was a rock climber, I think it was easier for him because he was small and like kind of a wiry build. So he ended up actually following some of our best breakdown navigators through like some of their scariest breakdown. And, you know, I think he wasn't as comfortable with it as those of us who have been in a lot of breakdown, but he was absolutely intrepid. Like the only thing I could possibly say about him is that I think he got lost a little more easily. We had to kind of make sure we didn't like ditch him in a rough turn, just because I think maybe they weren't as used to breakdown navigation, which that's not really a strength of mine either. So I get that. But I mean, they were all really impressive contributors. The other guy, the mountain guide, he was kind of with Bill. So he was down there for, I don't know, 25, 27 days. While Bill was doing a really huge aid climb in Harmony Hall at the bottom with Gilly Elor. And when he came out, he definitely was like not psyched on the cave. Like, I think he could mostly be seen like sitting in the sun with his sunglasses on for the last couple days of the expedition. I saw him on the way out and I was like, man, how are you doing? And he's like, yeah, I didn't really know I was going to be down there for that long. And we were like, yeah, we kind of thought you might be down there for that long. So sorry about that. But they were great. I mean, I was super impressed by them. And I mean, the thing about caving is that it's just not that hard. Like Cheve is a serious cave and like, there's a lot of physically hard things that you have to do. But I think in terms of the pure aerobic endurance and like the pure strength that you need to do really hard rock climbing or serious mountaineering and alpinism, those things are going to prepare you pretty thoroughly for the kinds of physical demands that Cheve places on you. So I think it's more mental and it's mental for all of us. I mean, I don't know that any of us would have wanted to stay in the cave longer when given the chance to exit after, you know, 27, 29 days, whoever did those super long stays.
Oh man. Okay. I'm kind of speechless after that. That's terrific. Okay. Remind me of the title of the documentary again. Do you have it handy?
I don't know actually exactly what it's going to be called. It's just, it's going to be an episode of Nat Geo Explorer. And I think it is an episode of Nat Geo Explorer specifically about Bill Stone. So, but I know they're going to be telling the story of the expedition as well as the story about Bill. It's not just about him.
So I mean, Riley, what's next for you? I'm sure you got a lot on your radar, but what would you like to see happen in the next few years?
Well, I've been joking that my expedition caving career is over.
Wait, what? Why?
Because, so I'm in college. I went back to college last fall.
That doesn't mean anything.
I'm in an undergrad and I work in Dr. Barton's lab. So I am continuing to cave, but I'm very committed to the college process. So like I'm not, for example, basically all three of my best friends and my partner and my lab mate coworker are all going to Cheve next season. And I'm not. I'm gonna be here taking classes.
Oh, okay.
So I'm very committed, like, to finishing school and
good for
doing
you.
A good job with school. Jim Smith told me one time that it only took him like 19 expedition seasons to finish his undergrad or something like that. I was like, all right, you know, Jim, I look up to Jim a lot and I would love to do things that way, but academically, I'm not sure I could swing it personally. So the next couple of years for me look pretty school heavy. I'm hoping, if my class schedule allows, to participate in an expedition to the Tears of the Turtle this summer.
Oh, man.
Which I'm pretty scared about, honestly. But a lot of people...
You should be, from what it seems like.
Yeah, it's intimidating. But a lot of people that I really like will be there. And I've been trying to go there since I met Jason in 2018. I've been excited about it. So I'm hoping to do that. I definitely will be a repeat participant in the Bridger-Teton Cave Project in Wyoming, which I've done for the past 2 years. Two of my best friends, Philip Moneyhunt and Penelope Forster, have been working on that for a couple of years. So I've just really enjoyed having the chance to do that with them. We've known each other since high school. So a big part of what I like about that project is just to get out in the wilderness with them. But the caves are really beautiful out there as well. And after school, who knows? I mean, I think the likelihood is that I will finish my degree, hopefully, and want to take a couple of years to do more caving again. I'd like to do more work like I did last summer, which was I was an environmental technician doing mostly cave biodiversity work in Virginia with the state Karst Protection Program there. That was really phenomenal. I'd like to do more stuff like that once I have the education to support it. So I think it's pretty wide open, but I'm going to try to do expeditions out west over the summers and hit it hard in Germany Valley and Maryland. And that's about all I have planned.
That'll do. That'll do for sure. I admire your experience, your dedication, and good for you for wanting to take school seriously and get it done and knocked out. I mean, I think that you'll find that I don't have anywhere near the experience that you do, but I think that you'll find that getting that out of the way rather than having that be a monkey on your back, finishing that will serve you well and have momentum. And with a mentor like Hazel right now, I mean, you know, she's only going to say the same thing. Riley, thank you so much for your time and thanks for everything you've done for caving.
Oh, thank you. It's been a fun interview.
Man, what did you think of that? National Geographic Explorer, like she said, coming out in May. Might see a split second of Riley in there somewhere. Mostly it's about Bill Stone, and I'll be one of the first ones watching it as soon as it drops on Disney+. Hey, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors, past and present. Swago, swagogear.com. Get you one of those packs. One of the only waterproof caving packs available. Plus, the new packs are shiny. And also Organic Robot Designs. If your grotto wants to make t-shirts for a fundraiser or just because, Charlie will hook you up. He's got his own screen printing business there in Greenfield, Indiana. Just Google Organic Robot Designs. You can buy his shirts. And he's got great original designs on Etsy as well if you want to order. And of course, our current sponsor, El Spelio. Go to elspelio.com and enter the promo code podcast and save $20 on any regularly priced headlamp or any order of $300 or more. And again, if you want to try out the Lunatic before you buy it, send me an email, alpineproductions@gmail.com. I got a few people I'm considering. I'd love to put you on the list. As long as you're going to put it through its paces and as long as you're going to send it back, I would love to send it to you. Elspelio.com, promo code podcast. All right, I think that's everything. I think I know who I'm going to have next month, but we haven't done the interview yet, so I'm not going to guarantee that that's who I'm going to have. But I'm looking forward to it, so you should too. I'll talk to you on March 1st. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto.
kill nothing but time.